Hey everyone, welcome back. Today we're going to be taking a deep dive into some texts you might not have heard of.
Oh, okay.
The Apocrypha. These are ancient Jewish writings that didn't quite make it into the official Bible. But trust me, they're anything but boring. We've got lectures from Dr. David DeSilva.
Oh, cool.
He's a leading expert on the Apocrypha, and he's going to help us unpack some really fascinating insights from three specific books: Wisdom of Solomon, Greek Esther, and Third Maccabees.
What's really striking about these texts is how they wrestle with these issues that are still so relevant today, questions about faith and identity and how to live in a world where you're not always accepted,
So it's like we're holding up a mirror to these ancient Jewish communities, specifically those living in Egypt under Roman rule. And let me tell you, their experiences were a wild ride.
We'll see how they dealt with everything from pressure to assimilate
All right.
to outright persecution. We'll even discover some unexpected explanations for things like the origins of pagan religions.
And get this, we'll even encounter some ancient prayer practices that make kneeling by your bed seem pretty tame in comparison.
It's a journey that might challenge some of your assumptions and give you a whole new perspective on the complexities of religious history.
Yeah, absolutely. First up, let's tackle Wisdom of Solomon. This text, likely written in Alexandria, Egypt, really just plunges headfirst into this classic battle between the righteous and the ungodly. You might think you know this story, but there are some seriously nuanced psychological insights here that might surprise you.
The author doesn't just tell us who's good and who's bad. He actually gets inside the minds of the ungodly, highlighting their short-sightedness and obsession with immediate gratification.
It's almost like they're living by the motto, YOLO, you only live once. But this live for the moment philosophy leads them down a pretty dark path.
They prey on the vulnerable, they exploit the poor, they disregard the elderly. It's a picture of a society that has lost its moral compass, and it's not pretty.
Dr. DeSilva even suggests that these ungodly figures might represent progressive Jews
Oh, interesting.
who were kind of ditching traditional Jewish law to fit in with the dominant Greco-Roman culture. It's a glimpse into the internal tensions within the Jewish community at the time, tensions that probably feel very familiar even today.
Absolutely. There's this real struggle between holding on to your identity and trying to belong in a world that doesn't always accept you.
And the author really drives this point home when he describes the ungodly targeting the righteous, almost like they're trying to snuff out their faith through persecution.
But here's where the author turns the tables. He contrasts the mindset of the ungodly with that of the righteous, who are deeply rooted in their faith, and they believe that God created them for a purpose that extends beyond this earthly life.
They have this unwavering hope for incorruption and immortality. Basically, the idea that death isn't the end and that righteousness leads to a life beyond this one.
It was a concept that was hugely influential on early Christian thought. And there's this beautiful passage in Wisdom of Solomon. It's often used in funeral services even today. It describes how the souls of the righteous are in the hand of God, and no torment will ever touch them.
It's this powerful statement of comfort and hope in the face of suffering and loss. It's interesting how this idea of God testing and refining the righteous, like gold in a furnace, also pops up throughout the New Testament. It speaks to this idea of spiritual growth through trials and tribulations, which is a theme that resonates across different religious traditions. But here's where things get really interesting. The author of Wisdom of Solomon doesn't just condemn pagan religion outright. He actually tries to explain its origins in a surprisingly empathetic way.
Rather than simply dismissing idol worship as wrong,
Right.
he offers some compelling explanations for how it might have developed. For instance, he tells a story about a grieving father who creates an image of his deceased child as a way to cope with his loss. And over time, this image becomes an object of veneration, eventually evolving into idol worship.
It's like he's saying that idol worship might have sprung from a very human desire for connection, even with those who have passed on.
He also proposes another theory. this time linked to politics.
Okay.
He describes how a skilled craftsman might create a magnificent statue of a distant ruler.
Mm-hmm.
And before you know it, people begin to worship the image
oh.
as a way to flatter the king and curry favor.
It's fascinating how he connects idol worship to these basic human desires.
Yeah.
The need for connection,
right.
the desire for belonging,
mm.
and even the ambition for power. It challenges us to look beyond simple judgments and consider the deeper motivations behind seemingly strange or foreign practices.
It's a reminder that sometimes what we perceive as wrong or primitive might actually stem from very human and relatable impulses.
Okay, so we've seen how Wisdom of Solomon tackles the battle between good and evil,
right.
dives deep into the psychology of both the righteous and the ungodly,
mm-hmm.
and even offers some unexpected perspectives on the origins of pagan religion.
Yeah.
But there's another intriguing question that the author tackles.
Okay.
The question of why God didn't just wipe out the Canaanites when the Israelites entered the Promised Land.
This is a topic that has generated a lot of debate and different interpretations throughout history.
Right.
But the author of Wisdom of Solomon offers a unique and thought-provoking perspective.
He suggests that God, in his mercy, wanted to give the Canaanites a chance to repent and turn away from their ways.
Mm-hmm.
It's a far more compassionate interpretation than what we find in some other biblical text, which portray God as more swift and decisive in his judgment.
However, there's a twist.
Okay.
The author also suggests that God knew deep down that the Canaanites wouldn't change their ways.
Oh, wow.
It's almost like a commentary on the human tendency to cling to familiar patterns.
Right.
Even when faced with overwhelming evidence to the contrary.
It's like he's saying that even God's mercy has its limits.
Yeah.
And that sometimes people are simply unwilling to embrace change, even when it's for their own good.
It's a pretty sobering thought.
And it raises some huge questions about the nature of free will,
mm.
the complexities of divine justice,
yeah.
and the human capacity for transformation.
It's a lot to chew on, that's for sure.
It is. And it's just a taste of the kind of thought-provoking insights we can find in the Apocrypha.
Oh, absolutely.
So we've explored the psychological depths of Wisdom of Solomon.
Right.
But our journey through the Apocrypha is far from over.
Yeah.
Next, we'll step into the world of Greek Esther, where we'll encounter a very different version of a familiar biblical story.
Buckle up, because this one is going to shed light on ancient anti-Semitism,
okay.
the challenges of maintaining Jewish identity in a diaspora,
yeah.
and even some surprising ancient prayer practices.
Oh, this is going to be good.
It is.
Okay, so we're moving on to Greek Esther. Now, you probably know the basic story of Esther from the Hebrew Bible, but get this, there's another version, a Greek version.
Right.
And it throws some serious curveballs into the mix.
The Greek version is much more explicitly religious. It's packed with prayers, divine intervention is front and center, and there are six whole additions to the story we know.
Six additions. Well, that's a lot of extra material. What kind of stuff are we talking about? Give us the juicy details.
Well, we get to peek into Mordecai's dreams. We get the full text of Esther and Mordecai's prayers, and Haman's anti-Jewish decrees are spelled out in detail. But one of the most striking additions is the description of Esther's prayer practice.
Okay, now that you mention it, I do remember something about sackcloth and ashes. It's not exactly the serene image of prayer that comes to mind.
Right. It's a far cry from quietly kneeling by your bed. We're talking about intense, embodied prayer. Esther the queen puts aside her royal robes and covers herself in sackcloth and ashes.
Oh, wow.
She's even described as smearing herself with, well, let's just say it wasn't exactly a luxurious spa treatment.
Wow, that's a powerful image. It makes you realize that prayer in the ancient world was often a full-body experience, a physical expression of humility and repentance. It makes you wonder if we've lost something by making prayer so well internalized.
That's a really interesting point. The Greek version of Esther really forces us to confront how differently prayer was viewed and practiced back then.
And speaking of confronting things, Dr. De Silva points out how Greek Esther really shines a light on the anti-Semitism that was brewing in that period. Haman's speech where he blames the Jews for societal unrest because of their peculiar laws and refusal to fully assimilate is downright chilling.
It's almost like a blueprint for the kind of anti-Semitic rhetoric we've sadly seen throughout history. The idea that Jews are somehow disloyal or dangerous because they maintain their own traditions and refuse to completely blend in It's a prejudice that has persisted for centuries.
It makes you wonder if those tensions existed back then. How much have things really changed? Are we still grappling with the same issues of religious tolerance and cultural acceptance today?
It's a question worth pondering, and the Greek version of Esther doesn't shy away from showing how those tensions played out even within the Jewish community itself.
Right. There's that part where Esther talks about how she avoided eating with Gentiles and even expresses disgust at sharing a bed with her uncircumcised husband, the king. That's pretty intense. It seems like even being queen didn't shield her from the pressure to conform.
Exactly. This addition to the story is a way for the author to emphasize Esther's unwavering commitment to Jewish law and her determination to maintain her own identity even within a royal marriage. Talk about pressure. It makes you wonder how she navigated those cultural boundaries on a daily basis.
It really does. It also highlights this constant tension between wanting to belong and needing to stay true to your beliefs. Mm. It's like she's saying, I can be part of this world, but I'm not going to compromise who I am.
And that message comes through much more forcefully in the Greek version than in the Hebrew version, which is more ambiguous about Esther's relationship to her Jewish identity.
So by adding these details, the Greek version is making a statement. It's saying that holding on to your faith and traditions is worth fighting for, even when you're facing immense pressure to conform. It's a message that must have resonated with the Jewish communities living in the diaspora, surrounded by a culture that was often hostile to their beliefs.
Absolutely. Greek Esther provides a powerful lens for understanding the complexities of Jewish identity in a world that demanded assimilation. But this theme of religious persecution and the struggle for cultural survival isn't limited to Greek Esther.
You're right. Dr. De Silva mentions another book from the Apocrypha that echoes these themes, Third Maccabees. And from what I've heard, it's a real nail-biter.
Third Maccabees is another work of historical fiction set in the Egyptian Jewish community. But this time, under the rule of the Ptolemies, think ancient Egypt pharaohs and a whole lot of drama.
And it's got a plot that's kind of similar to Second Maccabees, right?
Yeah.
With lots of persecution and divine intervention.
There are definitely some parallels in terms of themes and structure, but it's a completely separate story. And despite the name, it doesn't actually involve the Maccabees themselves.
Okay, now that's just confusing. So what's the real story here? What happens in Third Maccabees?
Well, it all starts with Ptolemy V, who's feeling pretty triumphant after a big military victory. He decides to swing by Jerusalem on his way back to Egypt and make a grand entrance into the Holy of Holies in the temple.
Uh-oh, that doesn't sound like a good idea. Didn't we learn anything from those other stories about messing with the temple?
You'd think so, right? But Ptolemy doesn't heed the warnings of history. And just like Heliodorus in 2 Maccabees, he's met with a supernatural force that throws him to the ground, sending him back to Egypt with his pride wounded and a thirst for revenge.
Okay, so bad move on Ptolemy's part. But how does this lead to trouble for the Jews in Egypt?
Well, Ptolemy, feeling humiliated and vengeful, decides he needs to deal with what he perceives as the Jewish problem in his kingdom. But instead of outright persecution, he tries a different tactic, forced assimilation.
It's a bit like Haman's approach in Greek Esther, but with a twist. He's not trying to eliminate the Jews. He's trying to absorb them into the dominant culture. It's like he's saying, you can stay, but only if you become like us.
Exactly. He offers them Alexandrian citizenship, a highly coveted status at the time, but with a catch. They have to participate in the local pagan religion. It's a classic case of, you can be one of us, but only if you abandon your core beliefs. It's a dilemma that many minority groups have faced throughout history, the pressure to conform in exchange for acceptance and belonging.
So how do the Jews respond to this offer? Do they give in to the pressure?
The vast majority refuse. Out of millions of Jews in Egypt, only a tiny fraction, about 300, agree to Ptolemy's terms. This act of defiance infuriates the king, confirming his suspicions about Jewish stubbornness and disloyalty.
It's amazing to think that so many people were willing to risk everything for their faith. It makes you wonder what gave them that strength and resilience.
It speaks to the power of belief and the importance of community in the face of adversity. These people were willing to stand together, even when it meant facing unimaginable consequences.
And what were those consequences? What did Ptolemy do when he realized that his plan for forced assimilation had backfired?
Well, let's just say he didn't handle it well. He orders all the Jews in Egypt rounded up and brought to the Hippodrome, which was essentially a giant arena to be trampled to death by elephants.
Elephants? Seriously. That's brutal, even for ancient times. Talk about a spectacle of terror. It's hard to even imagine the fear and despair those people must have felt.
It's a horrifying image, and it deliberately echoes the persecution faced by the Jews under Antiochus III and the Second Maccabees. But just when all hope seems lost, divine intervention kicks in big time.
Okay, so we got elephants, right? and a very ticked off Ptolemy. What happens next?
Well, just when it seems like curtains for the Jewish community, God steps in, not once, not twice, but three times. Ptolemy tries to unleash these elephants, and each time something stops him. Angels appear, the elephants get spooked, and they end up charging at their handlers instead of the Jewish people.
Talk about a divine intervention. It's like something straight out of a movie.
Right. It's this incredible moment of divine protection and a pretty clear message to Ptolemy that he's messing with the wrong people.
So what does Ptolemy do? Does he just give up and let the Jewish people go?
Well, the story suggests that he eventually recognizes the error of his ways, repents, and sends the Jews home. He even throws in apologies and supplies for a big 14-day feast.
That's quite the turnaround. So everything's hunky-dory now.
Yeah.
Everyone's happy.
Well, not quite. The story takes a bit of a dark turn here. Ptolemy actually grants the Jewish community permission to execute those who abandoned their faith and sided with him.
Oh, wow. That's heavy. It really highlights the tension and the pain of betrayal within the community.
It definitely raises questions about justice, forgiveness, and the lasting impact of persecution.
Okay, so we've talked about the persecution, the drama, but there's another really important aspect of Third Maccabees that we haven't touched on yet, those powerful prayers. Dr. Da Silva really emphasizes the prayer of Simon the High Priest and another by Eleazar. What struck you about these prayers?
What I find fascinating is how they weave in all these scriptural precedents for God's intervention. It's not just, oh, please help us, God. They're reminding God of how he's acted before.
So it's like they're saying, remember the Red Sea, God. Remember Daniel in the lion's den. We could really use a similar miracle right now.
Exactly. They're drawing on those stories, on their scriptures, as a source of hope and a foundation for their faith.
It makes you think about how we use those kinds of stories from our own traditions to get us through tough times, whether they're religious or just part of our family history.
It's about connecting to something bigger than ourselves, remembering that others have faced challenges and come out stronger on the other side.
And speaking of connections, Third Maccabees really highlights the bond between those diaspora Jews in Egypt and Jerusalem.
Right. Even though they're physically miles apart, that spiritual connection to Jerusalem, to the temple, is so strong.
It's like Jerusalem is this spiritual anchor, even for those who have made their lives elsewhere.
And the fact that God ultimately saves them from Ptolemy's wrath really reinforces this idea that God's protection extends to all his people, no matter where they are.
It's a powerful message of inclusion. You don't have to be in a specific place to be faithful or to experience God's presence.
Absolutely. Third Maccabees really affirms that God's power goes beyond any physical boundaries.
So as we wrap up this deep dive into the Apocrypha, it's clear that these texts are anything but boring or irrelevant.
Right. They offer these incredible glimpses into the lives and beliefs of these ancient communities, and they grapple with these big questions that are still so relevant today.
It makes you wonder how our understanding of faith and history might be different if these texts had been included in the official Bible. What voices and perspectives are we missing?
That's something to think about. It reminds us to stay open to different perspectives, to explore those less well-known corners of history and faith.
And as we finish up here, I'm curious, how do these ancient stories of resilience, faith, and identity resonate with your own experiences?
How do you navigate those same pressures to conform, those challenges to your beliefs?
We've seen how these communities found strength in their traditions, in their connection to God, and in each other.
What gives you that same strength and resilience in your own life?
Thanks for joining us on this fascinating journey through the Apocrypha. Until next time, keep exploring, keep questioning, and keep diving deep.